Hinder in the morning, only on Sportsnet 960 The Fan.
Standing in the rain with his head hung low, couldn't get a ticket, it was a sold out show. Heard the roar of the crowd.
702.
Oh, don't cut it. Leave it.
Put his ear to the wall, then like a distant scream.
Right here.
He heard one guitar.
We can cut it.
Friday at 7:03.
Look out.
And Mr. Labardius has got your artist of the day. It's, I think we were actually mocking this band just a week ago.
Good. Perfect. I love it.
Wasn't me. Probably Boom. But you know what I mean.
That's fine.
A little Foreigner on your Friday. Why not?
It's good for me.
Now, one guitar? Two guitars? How many guitars? One guitar?
Yeah, he has one guitar.
Yeah, one guitar! Going to talk some NHL and Major League Baseball before we get to 8 o'clock. Stephen Brunt will be by in about 20 minutes' time. His Ticats suffering a loss last night, right on the heels of his proclamation that they're the best team in the CFL by some measure. After that, John Shannon on the expansion what have yous surrounding the NHL. He is sort of skeptical or confused by the process. Maybe there's a relocation. That's sort of what we spent the last part of the 6 o'clock hour talking about, and John has the intel and the insight to take that conversation a little bit further. We'll do that at about 7:45. Special visitor, if you are a BT viewer on a regular basis, Tara Sloan, it's her final day on Breakfast Television, I'm told. Is that right, Jay? That can't be right. Apparently they're giving her presents. I'm watching it on TV when they're not doing their usual news and barbecuing on Fridays and hey, look, there's a pet in the studio, whatever it is. They're saying goodbye, which is crazy. So she's going to stop by and we'll pry. We'll see what she's up to, because if she's leaving here, it's got to be for something special, I would suggest. And on top of that, we still have to figure out what Lou thinks. We wonder what Lou thinks very often. And there's some good topics today. We've already broached a few of them, but we will wonder and we will get answers on what Lou thinks at 8:20 before we wrap things up with what you want to talk about at 8:40. At this point, want to play a conversation, and Lou, you and I will come back and react to this. About 7 minutes of Devin Setoguchi yesterday on air in Toronto. He has signed a tryout with the Toronto Maple Leafs. No guarantees, but he's got an invite to camp and openly discussed some issues that he battled throughout his career, but certainly last year. Things did not go as well as many had hoped here in Calgary. He was signed in late August. Hey, why not? Low risk, high reward. Didn't work. Ended up in Adirondack. Didn't even finish the season there. Came out and said, look, I had some issues to deal with. He says he's dealt with them. That conversation. Andrew Walker with Devin Setoguchi now.
Tell me about the opportunity here in Toronto with the Maple Leafs. I know I talked to you last summer a little bit. You had a couple of options. Did you have more than one option here? What works with Toronto and trying to earn a spot here?
Well, I was in a tough position this year. A lot of things have been going, but you know, I ended up going to rehab in April.
Yeah.
And, you know, going there, kind of hurt around the league. My rep, the last couple of years, and my word has not really meant much. I had got to the point where I had pretty much, diminished any kind of, merit in the league, and no one really, you know, believed what I was saying. So, I mean, I still have a lot to prove this year. And I feel thankful that Toronto was able to, you know, give me the PTO. And I had talked to Lou last summer. And for me, it was really one of my only few options I had. And I played under a guy named, Todd McClellan in San Jose,
mm-hmm.
who, ran a lot of structure, ran a tight, tight group of guys, very, very professional in what they did. And I know that for a fact, I'm sure he learned it from a guy like Mike Babcock. So it really was something that came down to, they're trying to do something there and turn that team into a great franchise. And not that it isn't already, but there, you know, that's someone that I would like to, you know, basically try to be a part of and push for moving forward.
Devin Setoguchi, our guest, you're a real good hockey player. You put up 65 points in San Jose. You've scored 23 times. You've scored 30 once. You're still a young guy. There's a good hockey player in there. What was it? A lot of success too early? Was it taking it for granted? Was it a certain lifestyle? Where did you find you ran into trouble a little bit?
I mean, I'd say it's everything. You know, it's everything. And lifestyle, definitely one of them. You're a young kid making $3.5 million and coming from, you know, not much. Things can get a little out of hand. And then you can get really conceited and cocky and overconfident in what you do. And your attitude is basically, it's not where it should be. And that was something that hit me. And then obviously along the way, got into the bad decisions and hanging out with the wrong people. And then, you know, just something where I took a wrong turn. And once I took that turn and knew it, I was in denial of it, and it was everyone else's problem. So for me, I mean, I'm just so thankful I get this chance. And I know it's not going to be easy. It's going to be tough. And, you know, my expectations going into camp is to, you know, all the odds are stacked against me. But I get a chance, and I'm just really excited. And I really hope that things can work out.
I always think it's interesting to measure where we are in life sometimes from year to year. And a year ago, you had a pretty decent opportunity with the Calgary Flames, and they ended up being one of the stories of the season. Your 2014-2015 year did not go at all how you hoped it would. You only played 31 games. Describe your headspace now compared to one season ago. How night and day is it?
It's night and day. I had convinced myself. Well, first off, I got to say thanks to Calgary. Anyway, you know, they gave me a chance, and you know, I told them, you know, going into camp that I was, you know, I was straight. I was, you know, I was going to stay sober for the year, and you know, not drink, and you know, that lasted all of a couple weeks. You know, there's a lot of things that went on there that were all strictly me and my problems that I did, and I didn't really take advantage of an opportunity in a team like Calgary, and so for me that was tough for me because I had a lot of expectation. I had a good summer training, but not quite as good as I, you know, have had this summer, and I just went in there and had a crappy attitude, and it was the coach's fault. Then it was the guys I was playing with's fault, and then it was once I got sent down, it was everybody else's fault, and it was never my fault, and that's when things turned bad. And you know, there's a lot of things in my head that I just needed to clear up, and personal problems, and I'm far beyond that, and I'm so thankful to the league for letting me go into the program and come out and still move forward. I mean, I still got a lot of work to do, and it starts with this camp and getting a great start there.
I was going to ask you, when you feel you got a fresh start, when you're as motivated as you are, how different does your off season look? I mean, you train differently, obviously, at 28 than you did at 18. But are there new wrinkles? Is there a new routine? Where are you at?
There's a lot of new. The game nowadays is so fast. Compared to when I broke in the league, you know, you had to be big and strong, and that was it. You know. Bronner was going to push you in the corner and beat the crap out of you.
Yeah.
You know, it was guys like that. And now it's fast. Everyone can skate. And if you're not in shape and you're not quick and you can't sustain that energy level and your energy systems for that 40, 45 seconds, you're not going to be able to play at the pace that you need to play at. So that's kind of what I've been trying to focus on the most. My weight has been an issue over the last, you know, 4 years. And, I'm under 200 pounds. I haven't been under 200 pounds in probably 9 years. So that feels good for me to get on a scale in the morning and finally be under 200 pounds and you know, look lean and feel great. And, you know, that just makes me feel good about myself as well.
You mentioned you had talked to Lou, was it right? So Lou Lamoriello in New Jersey?
Yeah.
And that was last offseason. Who was the driving force behind this? How did this opportunity in Toronto come about? Was it more you? Was it those previous dealings with Lou? How did it happen?
No, I think it was a mix between my agent and getting a hold of those guys. There wasn't a lot of opportunity for me with the amount of times that I've consistently let people down. There wasn't too many takers on giving me a chance this year, and so I think Toronto was one that was really, really, was entertained the idea and had known that I'd went through the program and had, been doing well so far and really stuck their neck out for me. And that's something that's kind of pushed me to, not let them down and just go and give it my all that I have and my one last crack at getting back and doing what I can to keep playing the game that I love to play so much.
That is Devin Setoguchi in conversation with Andrew Walker in Toronto. Setoguchi, the former Flame, a failed attempt to revitalize his career last year that ended up in the AHL and then into rehab, but says he's now clean. He also mentioned in there he told the Flames he would get off of his substance abuse issues, and it lasted all of a few weeks. Lou, just thoughts reacting to that conversation. Pretty candid, Devin Setoguchi, and I suppose at this point there's not a lot left to hide. You've got to be upfront and honest if someone is going to give you another chance to get your career back.
Well, I have some pretty strong feelings on this individual and this subject, and the first thing I want to say is I've known him since he was a 16-year-old member of the Saskatoon Blades. And I always, for the 2 or 3 years that I dealt with him on a very regular basis being in Saskatoon, thoroughly enjoyed him. He was fun to be around, obviously had some great talent, very courteous, very respectful. Last year, dealing with him, I don't know how many times I looked at Derek or Patty and said, that's not the same kid I used to know. And in hearing that interview, I'm proud of him. I'm really proud of him because there is nothing more difficult in this world when you go through some tough times than to have to look in that mirror and say, it's not about that person, that person, that person, or that person. It's about me. And I need to fix it. And it's a hard road, and it doesn't happen overnight. And as my significant other says, and it's one of my favorite sayings now, when you come back from tough situations, it's about progress. It's not about perfection. But I found that interview fantastic. That's more the Devin Setoguchi I know, and I'm pulling for him. I'm pulling for him because it's hard to come back from where he's been. He's got a lot of work to do. He's nowhere near the player that he once was. But as a person, I believe he's really taken the first step towards getting himself back. And you need to get you back before you can be the best you can be.
Did you suspect this was happening last year? Is
yes.
that what you're alluding to when you said that's not the guy I used to know?
Well, his attitude stunk. He wasn't approachable. He was hard to deal with. And, I don't know exactly what day it was, but I was on Hockey Central. And, somebody could go back and archive it. It doesn't matter. And listen, I really have a tough time being openly critical. And openly critical of athletes understanding how hard it is to be a good player in the NHL and also understanding a role of traveling with these people every day, being around them every day. I'd much rather be positive than negative, but you have to tell the truth. And, I think I said probably 10 days before, he was sent down that, listen, it is time for this player who, again, I said at that time, as I just did, I've known for a long time. He's got a lot of ability. But this is about him, and it's not about everybody else. And so I find that really refreshing. That kind of made my day to hear that interview and hear him talk in that candid manner.
Not a lot of teams would have picked up the phone if they saw the caller ID. I mean, you have to be... this was the same conversation we heard out of him last year, although it was a little more veiled. He talked about how he changed his habits in the offseason. He'd taken things for granted. He was going to get in better shape. He and Brad had met in person. And he was obviously trying. He knew it was an issue. He said it lasted a few weeks and not much longer. But, my goodness, there are not many teams out of 30 that would be open to even giving this guy a tryout.
And why would they?
Right, because he's said all the right things for a long time, but he hasn't done all the right things for a long time.
That's hard, Ryan. It's
gotta
hard.
Be. It's got to be immensely difficult.
It is really, really difficult. And, you know, I think in life, it's far more difficult for people who have climbed and, you know, in his case, fairly easily to the highest level, have all that success, make a lot of money. That's a big fall, my friend. That he's 28 years old. That's a big fall.
Should be in the wheelhouse of his prime right now.
Yes, he should.
Do you think he makes that team?
I don't know.
Not gonna
I don't
easy.
Know. You know what it's going to depend on? It's going to completely depend on, A, it's great to hear that he's in the best shape he's been in, obviously, for a long time. So that gives you a good start. He truly understands what the league is about by what he said. But, and hey, I get this as well as anybody. You can talk about it, and that's really important. The first step is understanding it's about you, and you need to fix it. But like I said, it's hard to do. So talking about it is the first step. The question is he ready now to fix it? And that's not necessarily an indictment on him if he can't. But as far as his National Hockey League career is concerned, he's out of chances.
This is it.
This is it.
And you know what? Here's the funny thing. He might be clean as a whistle and still not able to crack that roster because the game has changed as much and because he's... there's been some bad mileage, so to speak, in the last few years. That is a scenario that could play out.
Absolutely.
It'll be fascinating to follow. It is 7:19. We come back with Stephen Brunt. We'll switch gears. You know he's going to want in on the Jays. He's on his commute back from Newfoundland to Toronto. It's 3 days in a car. Actually going to Hamilton. Speaking of Hamilton, he just called them the best team in the league a few days ago. They got thumped last night. I shouldn't say thumped. Upset at home. Their first loss at Tim Hortons Field. We'll catch up with the road-tripping Stephen Brunt next on Sportsnet 960 The Fan.
Fan 960 Pinder on Twitter. This is Sportsnet 960 The Fan.
Brought to you by Glenmore Audi. Check out the 2015 Audi A4. With timeless style, German performance credentials, and unrivaled craftsmanship, the A4 is the ultimate overachiever. See for yourself.
Well, Stephen, we're ready. So I imagine you're pulled over on the side of a highway. It is time to apologize to the listeners of Calgary and acknowledge that Hamilton is not far and away the best team in the league, right? That's why you're calling today? Is that...
Well, that was. I think that was. I would like to think of that as a mere glitch. That was just, it happens. Hey, the Jays lost yesterday too. You know, even great teams occasionally lose. It's it'll all come out in the wash.
We've had some fun with it today, but it was perfect timing. As soon as they lost last night, I could not wait for our conversation this morning. They are now 10-1 at what they're calling the Donut Box, the worst named stadium in sport.
Yeah, I don't. Who does call it that anyway?
I don't know.
I think. Yeah, I think somebody in the Hamilton Spectator tried to invent a name. I think that's where it came from.
They should be fired. That's awful.
Yeah, no, I'm with you on that.
What happened? Where did things go wrong for the far and away best team in the CFL?
Well, they made some mistakes. They played against a team that's a very good defensive team. You could say that about. And they do seem to keep finding they have depth at quarterback. We know that they lost another guy last night and. Brought back a guy from injury who played really well, but very solid defensive team that played well, and Hamilton didn't play so well. They made mistakes, and at the point where it looked like they were going to have the dramatic comeback and at least tie it, a guy who's played awfully well this year made a mistake and threw an interception.
Give us the update. We'll leave you alone on the Hamilton stuff. We're just teasing you. They're certainly the class of the East in my mind, and I would expect them to be in a Grey Cup for the second straight year. But how is the return from the summer vacations going? Where do we find you today?
Well, you just on the just to the west of Montreal, in a very dirty car, jam packed with vacation detritus and a dog. So, so pulled over the side of the highway. People, you know what it's like, the classic driving trip. You know what your car looks like and what you look like. So that's kind of the state I'm in right now. But we'll be at the home office in Hamilton sometime this afternoon, and then. Back to reality, I guess.
Yeah, and if you don't smell bad enough on your own, good thing you've been sharing a vehicle with a car for 2 days.
Well, that's it, exactly. You know, so it's it'll be a relief to offload this stuff, and as I say, kind of get back into it. I'm not sure it'll be a relief to get back into the normal routine. I I'm used to looking out my window and seeing whales jumping around in the bay, but I guess I'll get used to that.
Yeah, fair enough. And we all do have to work at some point to enjoy our vacation. You're going to be heading home at the right time. Blue Jays fever is, well, unlike anything we've seen in the last 20 years. And I've been seeing some promos for a piece that you told us a few months ago you were working on. It's going to air, I believe, Sunday morning. Give us the details.
Yeah, I think 10 a.m. Sunday morning, which is not the greatest time in your time zone. I apologize for that. I assume it will air many more times, and you'll be able to stream it at sportsnet.ca, so you'll be able to find it. It is called Almost Perfect, and we are coming up on 25 years since Dave Steeb's no-hitter, the only no-hitter in Blue Jays history. So the idea is that we would go out and we wanted to do kind of an oral history of the game, you know, and talk to as many of the people who participated in the game as we could, and you know, and also people who, you know, broadcasters who broadcast the game, and we have Pat Gillick in there, who was the GM of the Jays at that time, and you know, thought, well, let's recreate this game as best we can from as many different perspectives. And then, except the only problem was Dave Steeb. You know, you assume, you know, this is the greatest moment in Dave Steeb's career. It's going to be no sweat. And we contacted him through the Blue Jays first of all, and a message came back. He said, "No, I don't want to do it."
What?
And then I said, "Well, that doesn't sound right, because this is, you know, this is a celebration of the greatest moment of his career. Why wouldn't you want to do it?" We went through all kinds of people. You know, Pat Henkin, you know, the former Jays pitcher, who's the bullpen coach, is a Jays advisor now, I guess, is a great pal of his. We went through Henkin. We went through everybody we could think of. Steve's agent, Bob Lamont, who's probably his closest friend. And no, which is, you know, as somebody who dealt with Dave Steeb in his prime and as a reporter, he's the most difficult athlete I've ever dealt with. You're just angry, irascible, difficult guy. So it kind of figured. But then I was out in Los Angeles, I think, doing stuff, Manny Pacquiao stuff, before the Pacquiao-Mayweather fight. We were about to fly to Reno to interview Bob Lamont, the agent. Steve actually lives like three blocks from him. And the night before we got on the plane, I got a call from Bob Lamont, and he said, "Dave's going to do it." So you will see the results in this. Dave Steeb is interviewed in the piece. We're going to do the piece without him. You know, just say Dave Steeb refused to participate in the story. But we did talk to him, and it's I think it's a really interesting piece. You know, you forget how good he was. You know, he threw, in addition to the no hitter, he had three no hitters broken up with two outs in the ninth. He had another no hitter that he took into the ninth, who was broken up with consecutive home runs in 1985. But he, in consecutive starts, he threw consecutive one hitters, both no hitters broken up with two outs in the ninth. You know, one with that famous bad hop ground ball over Manny Lee's head, and another one with a little blooper over first base that he still blames Fred McGriff for not catching, which is so Dave Steeb. 25 years later, he's still blaming Fred McGriff. So the gods yanked his chain a lot, and then they finally let him get the no hitter. So it's about him, about, you know, kind of that era, and then about the day he finally gets deliverance in Cleveland.
And boy, isn't it timely to be talking about some of those powerhouse teams from the early 90s right now, as the Blue Jays find themselves 15 games over 500 for the first time since 93.
Yeah, it's, you know, again, everybody remembers 92, 93, and, you know, how obviously those World Series teams, a lot of people who were alive then could, you know, recite the lineup from memory. But, you know, the fact is the Jays through the late 80s, you know, mid-80s, you know, into the early 1990s were good, you know, almost every year. They were snake-bitten some years. They had that horrible collapse in 87 that some folks may remember. You know, and Dave Steeb in 1982 was fourth in the Cy Young voting. You know, if you look at his stats from that year, they're unbelievable. So there was a whole decade there where the Jays were good, where they were in contention, where people kind of got used to them being in contention before the deliverance of those World Series. And, you know, the team changed a lot over that decade, and a lot of guys ended up being gone, including, you know, Steve was a peripheral guy by the time he got to 92, and he was off the team in 93. But that, you know, that was a it was a glorious and exciting time moving into the new stadium, all of the stuff that went with that, and it kind of feels like we're back there now.
Sunday, 11:05, first pitch. That Steve special that you put together will air an hour prior to first pitch. That'll be the finale of the Tigers series. Of course, we're chatting with Stephen Brunt, our good pal, right here on Sportsnet 960. The Fan, Ryan Pinder, alongside Peter Labardius.
Stephen, a number of places I want to go today. I want to go back to football in just a second, but yeah, it's funny when you think about the Blue Jays, and maybe it's a bit of a message to people right now who I think want it to go from zero to the World Series overnight. It was a process because some of us also remember the Jim Sundberg triple of the Kansas City Royals back in 1985 off the wall at Exhibition Stadium that might have derailed what could have been a first World Series.
Yeah, off Dave Steeb.
Yes.
You know, Dave Steeb was the pitcher. They brought him back on short rest, you know, and it was kind of a bit desperate because they had that series against Kansas City, the ALCS. They had that series in the bag, it looked like. And, you know, if they win that series, they, you know, quite possibly go on and win the World Series. It, and I'll never forget being watching that ball. It was just, it was a routine fly ball, got up in the wind. Mm-hmm. And and there was always a lot of wind at Exhibition Stadium and just kind of kept going and going and going. And then finally off the wall, that was the first heartbreak. You know, there were a few that came after that, and you know, also some kind of, I remember it's funny. We got, you know, R.A. Dickey, we got a knuckleballer in the rotation as a significant guy. Remember when they traded for Tom Candiotti?
Yes,
who was a knuckleballer, and he was the staff ace. Effectively, they went into the postseason again, as I remember, against Minnesota that year, and Candiotti started Game One and refused to throw his knuckleball. He threw bad fastballs. And got pounded. He lost confidence in his knuckleball. I remember everybody, you know, everybody in the Blue Jay organization going, "What's going on here?" It'd be like R.A. Dickey going up and just throwing fastballs. So you know, there were a lot of ups and downs during that decade before, you know, that final deliverance in '92.
Stephen, very touching last night. The Tiger Cats, and a couple questions here, but Angelo Mosca, a larger than life figure, of course, dealing right now with some, you know, pretty serious health issues. I just want your take on that whole part of last night, which for me, frankly, was far better than the game.
Yeah, well, Ange is a special character, you know. Yeah, he is. He has Alzheimer's, and you know, he's talked about that, and so it's out there. He is, you know, growing up in Hamilton as I did. You know, Angelo Mosca is kind of this mythical figure. He, if you cheered for another team in the CFL, you almost certainly hated him. If you cheer for the BC Lions, you especially hated him because of what he did to Willie Fleming in the Grey Cup game, which. You know, Ange forever said it was a clean hit. Everybody in BC said it was a dirty hit. It's still, you know, Jim Taylor's famous column and the headlines. It was, you know, they hated him. They hated him in all kinds of places. He, but, you know, he was this, you know, on a team that was really tough, great defensive team in the 60s with guys like John Barrow and Ellison Kelly and that crowd. Angie was like the cartoon bad guy. You know, he was the dirty, you know, quote unquote dirty player. You know, he went to Notre Dame and got thrown out of Notre Dame, I believe, for gambling. He is a rough guy. His exploits in Hamilton, you know, off the field were quite notorious. He once drove his car through the front door of a bar, perhaps doing something illegal, and ordered a drink through the driver's side window after he went through the door. You know, and then he had that second life as a professional wrestler. You know, where he was a wrestler. I've talked to Ange a bunch of times. One of the great kind of pleasures of my life, given that I grew up in Hamilton in that era, was getting to know him a little bit. You know, sitting in front of him in the press box, he's a sweet, sweet guy. You know, he is really a gentle giant. And you know, that sentiment, that outpouring you saw for him last night. It's, you know, 68, you know, number 68 in Hamilton will always. It's always going to be Angie. You know, it's, you know, he is Mr. Ticat in many ways. And I say there's people in other parts of the country who will say you can have him, but we'll take him.
So, Stephen, along those lines, I was surprised because I didn't know the history of how Hamilton necessarily went about their business. I was shocked a few weeks ago to read that this is only the second number retired in franchise history. I mean, you know, I'm old enough to remember him certainly, if not in the late 60s, but the early 70s. and yet stunned even weeks ago to find out that he was only number two. I would have thought that jersey, you know, I guess I've seen guys wear 68 over the years and never really thought much about it. But, I mean, if he wasn't up somewhere, you know, on a wall or on a flag, I mean, who would be?
Yeah, they have in Ivor Wynne, I got to remember in the new stadium what it looks like, but in Ivor Wynne, I'm sure they've transferred it over. They have kind of a wall of fame. Yeah, where they put the names up there, and it's, you know, kind of all the all-time Tiger Cats are up there. But yeah, they chose not to actually retire numbers. That they, you know, the numbers always stay in circulation. So you know, yeah, if you look at a Ticat roster, you can see guys wearing, you know, numbers that were attached to, you know, almost everybody in franchise history. You know, some that would be very identifiable if you're a Ticat fan. It's just that it's the way they've done business. But which is, you know, makes it, you know, doubly significant, the fact that they decided to put 68 to bed. You know, it's a great thing. And, you know, I say Ange is a sentimental guy. You know, he told me a great story once. They used to, you know, he was hated in almost every stadium in Canada other than Ivor Wynne. He actually played for the Ottawa Rough Riders for 1 year. Mysteriously, they kind of loaned him to Ottawa and then immediately got him back. I always thought they were trying to get him out of town for some other reason, probably. Maybe things are a little bit hot. But I remember he said they had a reunion of, that was the 1960 Ottawa Rough Riders Grey Cup team that he played on with Ronnie Lancaster and Russ Jackson. And you know, in visiting stadiums, they always used to have people had the same sign that they held up, and they unfurled this sign at the old Lansdowne Park. It said, "Mosca eats bananas," which is what they always. And he said, "I started to cry because once again, there it was, Mosca eats bananas." That was, you could see that in all eight other parks when he played for the Ticats.
Stephen, pleasure catching up. Welcome home, I suppose, when you get there this afternoon. And when we talk next week, you'll have time to soak up the atmosphere surrounding Southern Ontario and the Toronto Blue Jays as they open up a set with the Tigers tonight. Enjoy it, my friend.
All right. Take care.
Stephen Brunt, brought to you by Glenmore Audi. Check out the 2015 Audi A4. With timeless style, German performance credentials, and unrivaled craftsmanship, the A4 is the ultimate overachiever. See for yourself.
Always great catching up with Stephen, returning from the Newfoundland summer home. And yes, again, that Dave Steeb special will air Sunday morning prior to the Jays game. That is the Sunday matinee that will close the three-game set with the Tigers. If you have tickets, give them to Lou. That's what we're saying, right, Pete?
For Sunday?
Yes.
Yes, I'm available.
Okay, very good.
And willing.
7:40, we'll step aside. John Shannon, when we come back, are the Carolina Hurricanes possibly on the table in terms of relocation? What about expansion? Is it a slam dunk that Las Vegas and Quebec City both get teams that are brand new? John Shannon's got some questions. Sportsnet 960, The Fan.
Get connected. Text 960-960 to get your voice heard. Ryan Pinder in the morning on Sportsnet 960, The Fan.
On your Friday. Hope you got a great weekend teed up. Gonna warm up to, I believe, about a high of 25 today in Calgary. Still a little smoggy out there with all that smoke coming, I guess, up from the Pacific Northwest. Hopefully, sounds like they're gonna get some rain out on the Pacific coast there. That should settle those fires down. It looks like a couple more days of smoky skies expected, and then hopefully back to the summer norm. And for Mr. Labardius, the forecast, is it an open roof at the Rogers Centre tonight, are you guessing, or is it too soon to tell in Toronto?
I think it's too soon to tell. It's been one of those weeks that has not seen a lot of rain, but has looked every day like we might. So I'm really hoping for two evenings, or at least a night and a day of open, because it's just such a different place when the roof is open as opposed to when it's closed.
No question. R.A. Dickey against Matt Boyd. It's a 5:07 first pitch tonight from the Rogers Centre. Our next guest rose, I suppose, a bit more attention or interest in the expansion process just a couple days ago with a new article on sportsnet.ca. I want to say good morning to John Shannon, one of our NHL insiders. John, how are you?
Good boys. Roof will be open tonight. Don't worry. Roof will be open.
I like it. I like it. That sounds good. Listen, there's been some weird rumors, and I don't know where they started and if it was you or if you've sort of just repeated what you've heard elsewhere, but we all know that this expansion process is happening. We're in phase three, whatever that means. But now all of a sudden, the Carolina Hurricanes are a team that apparently, rumors mill says they might be moving. Maybe it isn't two expansion teams that get handed out.
Well, I don't think it's a rumor. I mean, Peter Karmanos has had this team for sale for a long, long time. Tried to sell 49% to people and maintain control. And I don't know why you'd give a guy, you know, more than $100 million not to have any say in it. And now he's in a bit of a financial pickle himself. So he's you know, looking to get rid of it. And the biggest issue has always been whether you could get out of the lease in Raleigh with the North Carolina State University, and it looks like you can. So I think that 1 and 1 equals 2, and I don't think it's a rumor. I think there's some truth to it.
And it's interesting. It's probably not the news the NHL wants when they're trying to ask for $500 million or so in expansion fees, because I would suggest you could purchase the Hurricanes for much less than that, and then it would be a matter of a relocation fee, which maybe the grand total of those two things is less than $500 million.
Or maybe it is $500 million. You know what I mean? I think that the great magic about a relocation fee is that Gary Bettman can make the relocation fee whatever he wants. And by doing that, you can solve a few problems. I think the Carolina situation, I don't think it was any fluke that the story came out this week. I think it's totally independent of expansion. What I would suggest is that Karmanos is trying to create some leverage to get people to buy in to keep the team in Raleigh.
It's kind of a have your cake and eat it too scenario. He wants someone else to put a whole bunch of dough into his project, and he still wants to control the wheel. You don't get any say. 49%. I mean, why should anyone do this for him?
Well, and for that very reason, Ryan, that's why the team hasn't sold in the 3.5 years it's been up for sale. You know, I mean, he's talked to a ton of people. Some that are well known, guys like Andrew Barraway, who has dabbled in trying to buy other teams, the Islanders, the Devils, the Coyotes, and he's talked to other people that names haven't been made public. But it all comes back to, well, if you're going to put that kind of money in, you better have some sort of say.
NHL insider John Shannon joins us on the phone line. It's Ryan Pinder in Calgary, and Peter Labardius joining us in Toronto studio.
John, I guess question number one for me would be, in your opinion, is this the right time for the league to expand?
No, I don't. I think the league is finally getting on solid footing almost everywhere. I think when you look at the good things that are happening in Florida, the good things that have happened in Tampa, and let's face it, you know, both of those teams have been money pits for a long period of time. You still wonder about Arizona, but at the same time, they're, you know, everything's pointing in the right direction. Bigger TV money, bigger ticket money, bigger marketing dollars. This new deal with Major League Baseball, with the growth of the digital world. I mean, things are looking really solid. And I just think it's a little premature.
John, you spent 10, 11 great days in Quebec City at the Memorial Cup, and obviously your history goes back to when they were still in the league. It wasn't that long ago. How about, in your estimation, the long-term viability of the NHL in that city?
I think it's a great question, and I think that that's exactly what the league's going through now, Peter. It's been 20 years since the Nordiques announced their move to Colorado. In fact, it would be about 20 years now, just as their first training camp was on the verge of starting for the Avalanche, and not much longer until they saw Patrick Waugh play. I mean, let's face it, that was the Patrick Waugh trade in December was the biggest was the biggest turning point in the franchise. Patrick Roy played in Quebec City, and then you'd have to think that the team would still be there. But at the same time, I think the world has changed. I think the business model has changed for professional sports teams. The sophistication of selling, the amount of revenue that is different. You know, in 1994, when the Nordiques were at their peak, and 95 when they left, the NHL was probably a $500 million business. $500 million. Now it sounds like a lot, but right now it's a $4 billion business, and things have changed. And there's expectations of corporate dollars, massive TV revenue locally in most cities. I mean, the Flames are going to be great winners of that story, as many Canadian teams are. The Montreal Canadiens are the most successful regional TV team. How is that going to be affected by what the Nordiques do? There's so many things that I just don't think it's a slam dunk or an empty net that the Nordiques are coming back.
I see what you're saying, but I'm going to play out one side of the argument for you. Why wouldn't this just be Winnipeg en français?
Well, because the business model is totally different in the province of Quebec and the joint ventures that the NHL has with the Montreal Canadiens in French. And when the Nordiques left, and 20 years ago, the Canadiens were not in that great a shape either. They weren't winning. They were struggling on so many ways. They built that brand new building. They weren't selling it out. They had to reinvent themselves, and they've done a magnificent job doing that. And the league and the team did a lot of stuff together to create that opportunity. I have some questions of whether it makes any sense to add a second team to that market and split the pie. And more importantly, how much money are you going to pay Jeffrey Molson and Michael Andlauer and the people that own the Montreal Canadiens in order to keep them happy, because that's their territory. And that's really where I think the storyline is. And I think people don't want to hear it. People are so in love with, well, the Nordiques have to come back. Look how good Winnipeg was. I don't think it's as simple as that. And from that perspective, I think the business plan has to be a lot more thought out. And I think that's why it's taking this much time. And that's why a few of us are getting hints that, this process is, it's not going to happen and be over in 2 weeks. And we decide that there's two new teams coming. I think they're going to take their time.
So to be clear, is there any room for interpretation in terms of those territorial rights that you speak of with Montreal, or is this just simply the NHL has deals with the Habs for Quebec, period, stop, complete sentence?
Just to be clear, all of North America is divided up for the 30 teams, and there are basically internal territories, the 50-mile radius, and then there are outer market rights. And Canada is divided, and a lot of it has to do, believe it or not, with the development of Sportsnet. Canada is divided into four regions. Ottawa and Montreal share the Ottawa Valley, Quebec, and the Maritimes, including Newfoundland and Labrador. So adding another team into that mix would change a lot, even for the Senators. So those things are defined. And if you change them for Quebec, why aren't you changing them for the Pittsburgh Penguins and the Columbus Blue Jackets? Why aren't you changing them for the Chicago Blackhawks and the Minnesota Wild? It's a Pandora's box you're opening up. So you have to have some continuity and consistency in order to make this work for all the teams in the NHL.
If there's a perfect scenario out there in 3 or 4 years, what do you see for this league? And I don't know whether this needs to be through your eyes or Gary Bettman's, but how many teams are there, and what is the East-West balance like? What markets are new?
Well, I think in the ideal world, I think they'd still like to see a team in Seattle and a team in another team in Southern Ontario. where they know there is a business model that works and they know that there's money at hand. And it, ironically enough, and I think when this when the applications for expansion went out, Ryan, the whole concept was that Seattle and Toronto were going to have bids. And neither Seattle nor a second team in Toronto created a bid because there aren't arenas to do it with. And that might be, in the end, one of the reasons why the league is kind of, you know, taking its time and doing this diligently and making sure that everything's done properly, because the last thing they want to do is expand to the wrong cities. And at the same time, be in a place where, you know, you have to write teams have to write a revenue sharing check. You know, Calgary wrote a revenue sharing check this year to teams that didn't make money. And the Leafs wrote the biggest check, almost $30 million.
Every year, it seems, yeah.
So do you want to add two teams? And sure, you're going to get your expansion fee, but do you want to keep writing those checks every year? Don't you want to have new partners come in that actually are money makers right away? And that's the big issue. That becomes another part of the equation.
And it's funny because the two teams they have very keen and in this expansion process, I don't think are slam dunks to be successes financially. I would think Quebec City would.
Why? If you're not going to be successful financially, why would you expand to them?
Well, and this is my whole point, John, is that I think the league looks a little silly through this whole process. They didn't get the markets they wanted.
Well, that's why, I mean, as I said, I think there's a, is it 100%? No, but I think there's a real possibility that they say, you know, we're just not ready to expand yet. And that was really, when I wrote that story a couple of days ago, that was really the underlining tone, was that, you know, hey, there's a chance that, you know, there are three options. You know, expand to two places, expand to one place, or don't expand at all.
Final one for you. What do you know about a Canadian dollar, let's say between 70 and 75 cents, and the economics for the seven clubs north of the border in terms of moving forward in this new climate?
It's all that's pretty subjective stuff. Most teams have been smart in the last couple of years. They still buy U.S. dollars. You know, the business is in U.S. money. Player salaries, almost all of their sponsorship dollars on a national basis come back to them in U.S. dollars. So they have to deal so much in U.S. And most teams, and I'm sure the Flames are a smart group too, they always buy U.S. dollars to hedge. So it won't affect them near as much. Now, it's still going to affect them on the bottom line when you consider, you know, the amount of exchange that they have to pay. But it's not as impactful to teams that turn a profit as it would be if you don't. I mean, I would suggest that it's probably harder on Ottawa than it would be on Calgary or Edmonton or Vancouver or Toronto.
Yeah, that's fair. Always enjoy the insights, John. Thanks so much for sharing some time with us on this Friday. Hope you have a great weekend, and we'll be fully tuned in watching this process play out. It sure is fascinating.
All right, boys. Good talking
to you.
Thanks,
John.
It's John Shannon of Sportsnet.ca. Quick reaction, anything there, Pete? I mean, there's a lot we touched there, and it's interesting to hear that point of view. It isn't the resounding one we've heard since the start of the process, which is, yay, everything's going to be great. Quebec City's coming in. Las Vegas is coming in. That's a bit of a reality check there, isn't it?
That probably describes John's thought process and his feelings better than anything else. It's, yes, on a grandeur type scale, it looks wonderful and exciting, and two new markets. And I know for personal reasons, I'd love to see another Canadian team, and I'd love to see the great city of Quebec City return to the NHL. But again, you know, what looks great sometimes on the surface, when further examined, doesn't make as much sense as you might think. And there are a lot of stipulations. And John mentioned, and I thought he did it eloquently and very well done, about, you know, Montreal and their situation and territorial rights and, you know, bringing into a TV market, into a Sportsnet channel, Sportsnet East, yet another team to go along with Ottawa and Montreal. So, you know, there's only so much of the pie for people to get. And, you know, we'll see. You know, I think always, Rye, the bottom line is, and it's my feeling and always will be, is, you know, why not at least put it in a place or give it a chance where you know people are going to care? And we know it's going to work, you know, in the stands in Quebec City. But unfortunately, sometimes there's way more to it than just that.
Yeah, there's some layers there I didn't even know existed or put any thought into. It's great points by John, and we thank him for his time. We're going to step aside when we come back in the 8 o'clock hour. Boy, lots to get to. We wonder about your thoughts, Lou. The new segment. I wonder what Lou thinks. We'll give that another spin for the fifth time this week, one a day. And on top of that, we will say goodbye to a friend who's leaving Calgary. We're not happy about it, but she gone. And of course, you'll drive us to 9 o'clock. The listeners control the ship here from 9:40 till 10. That is what you want to talk about. It's all ahead in your 8 o'clock hour on Sportsnet 960 The Fan.